Greetings from the Paleo Protestant Podcast co-hosts. That would be Miles Smith, Corey Moss, and myself, Daryl Hart. We haven't been together for a while. This time we're coming back together in, I don't know, I guess we haven't, I think we did a January show recorded. So this time we're going to talk about something that may be near and dear to my heart more than the other two interlocutors, which is hot Protestantism. There's a great book by Michael Winship that Yale published a couple of years ago called Hot Protestants. And it's a history, a very readable, breezy history of Puritanism. So Puritanism has a reputation of being hot in the Anglophone world, which is understandable, introspective, maybe a tad prone to emotional expressions of the faith. Conversionism, you could argue, comes out of that world in some ways. Presbyterians are in some ways bedfellows with Puritans at different times in different places. And so Presbyterians may be known as more hot or hotter than other than say Lutherans or Anglicans, which is ironic because Presbyterians are also known for being God's frozen chosen. I mean, there was once upon a time, Presbyterian worship was really dull, formal, cold, and people objected to that. That seems to have passed after the era of megachurches and contemporary worship, which isn't necessarily the case, the way Presbyterians worship in the United States. But so there's that odd dynamic for Presbyterians. But then when it comes to Anglicans, they have had to wrestle with comfortably, less comfortably, we'll find out more, with low church evangelicals. So there's a kind of hottish element there. And Lutherans themselves have also had their innings with pietists. Another perhaps variety of hot Protestantism. And one could argue, even say going back to the Reformation, and I mean, Corey, I easily take correction from you on this, but sometimes the way I read Luther and Calvin even is that in reaction to Rome's emphasis on the externals of the faith and that these externals always operate because that's the way God has chosen to bless his people. You know, Calvin and Luther are both sort of questioning that and wanting, by emphasizing faith as the vehicle that receives especially justification, there is a kind of internal dynamic that begins with Reformation Protestantism. And of course, Puritans and other groups later take that internal dynamic and begin to examine much more to see if signs of faith or grace are there. So anyway, that's sort of what we're here to talk about. And I guess, chronologically speaking, we should probably start with Lutherans to see what the current state of affairs are between confessional Lutherans and pietists.
The current state of affairs.
It any way you want to go. I don't.
Well, no, let's start with the current state of affairs. Because I don't know much about the current state of affairs. as with the Anglicans, I suppose perhaps less visibly with the Presbyterians. I mean, North American Lutheranism, and I think it's probably fair to say, you know, Western Lutheranism more broadly, has been caught up in, you know, sort of low church, evangelical, even mega church varieties of worship. That's certainly not typical of a denomination like the LCMS, but it's tolerated, to be sure, within LCMS circles. Back in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, we also had a serious conflict over charismatic gifts in the LCMS. And I mean, that pretty much disappeared as a public conversation, but I can say with some confidence that it hasn't entirely disappeared. It's just not talked about quite so much or publicized quite so much because, and for those interested in that kind of piety, it didn't go so well the last time around, that they weren't warmly received.
But that would suggest that there are charismatics still in LCMS circles. It's just not as visible or...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there's no attempt to kind of, at least that I'm aware of, there's no attempt as there was in the 60s and 70s to kind of steer the whole church body in that direction. Mm. I think that they've realized that that's not going to happen. So, the few of us who still speak in tongues aren't going to do it publicly and aren't going to advertise it. And so it's still there. And yeah, I mean, one of the great historical questions is, is this just a phenomenon of, a church in North America going through all of the whims of the other North American church bodies? Or is there some sort of connection back to, for example, Pietism?
Right.
And both arguments can be made. Certainly, if you're looking for some sort of historical Lutheran pedigree to sanction some of these practices, German Pietism is the place to go. And just to kind of briefly round out, I mean, I think you're right that, part of the Reformation critique of Catholicism was an emphasis on a certain interpretation of, the sacraments simply working by virtue of the work worked. You receive grace when you receive the sacrament, and it just the fact that it's done is sufficient. And the interior state of the person is perhaps irrelevant. I don't think Catholic theologians would have actually said it that way, but that was the impression that Luther and Calvin and others were reacting against. And so there was always a fine line. How do we emphasize the necessity of faith, which is, I hate to use the vocabulary, but it's an interior, a subjective thing. How do we balance that with the fact that the faith is directed towards an object which is external and objective? So the proclaimed word, the read word, the promises of the sacraments themselves. And so arguably, the great debates about piety in the history of the Lutheran tradition revolve around the question of which one gets emphasized. Hmm. Which one gets downplayed? How much does one get emphasized? How much does one get downplayed? And that probably accounts for a lot of the debates.
Just before I turn to Miles, do you see over the course of the 16th century with confessional documents a yin and yang there between the interior and the external, or is there largely one voice in the 16th century, and then when Pietism comes in the 17th, if that's the correct dating, then that takes on a different dynamic then. But the confessional tradition itself is fairly solidly.
This is a good question.
Formal. I don't know.
I think one could say that, and that's certainly the trajectory set in the 16th century, and maybe this is my biased reading, that trajectory does lead into things like Protestant scholasticism, mm-hmm. of the Orthodox dogmaticians of the later 16th and early 17th century, to which the Pietists are reacting, mm-hmm. as an overly formal, overly intellectual distortion of quote-unquote original Lutheranism. That's not the way I read it, although I can see how and why that argument would be made.
Yeah. What about your Anglicans, Miles?
I think the Anglican experience maps on to the LCMS one. There's a lot of commonality there. I think the Anglicanism's hot is really right now the major source of the heat is from charismatics more than what you might call low church evangelicals per se. I recall I was at a parish in North Carolina, and a very kind rector, actually from my hometown, was giving a sermon. He was talking about the great revivals in history, and I thought he said a lot of nice things about the Reformation, and then he immediately followed with, and then there was the Azusa Street revival. sort of tagging Azusa and the rise of modern Pentecostalism as sort of a chief legacy of the Reformation. And I think there's a lot of that in Anglican circles, largely because a lot of the Episcopal Church, the conservatism of the Episcopal Church after the 1970s was chiefly, not only, but largely in charismatic-leaning dioceses. The state of Virginia is a good example. A lot of charismatics in Southeast Virginia sort of kept the Episcopal Church from going off the rails with regards to doctrine of sin, sexuality, marriage, and stuff like that. So I think that the chief difference between, say, the ACNA and the LCMS is it would be as if the conservatives were the hot Protestants, and they formed a denomination. That's almost the way it's ended up working out. There are confessional leaning Anglicans. I would love to tell you that we're a majority. We're not at all. We're a minority. But the conservative energy within the Episcopal Church was through those hot Protestants. It was through charismatic leaning evangelicals. You could call them that, or just outright charismatics. So I think that in a lot of ways, that's the Anglican curse, is that currently a lot of the energy comes from people who 20 years ago were the conservatives. Now, of course, they have their own conservative denomination. What do you do with the fact that we are a church that has authoritative articles and formularies? So I think sort of now that there's been a separation from the Episcopal Church, the question is, what do you do with hot Protestants, especially because our tradition is not a hot one? So we're a hot denomination created out of a non-hot tradition.
But in terms of the low church tradition within American Episcopal, I mean, even in, you know, among evangelicals both sides of the Atlantic, is that still kind of a presence in Anglicanism, or is
really good question. I think there are people who would be called low church around in the rest of the Anglican communion who would not, in an American context, seem low church. Take, for example, a low church parish that doesn't do the imposition of ashes. There are those in the Anglican communion. There's several of them in our diocese, but they don't do Ash Wednesday because that's seen as a sort of a Tractarian innovation or something like that. Nonetheless, if you were to go to those churches, they would seem very high in practice because they use a very formal liturgy. They're usually very strictly wedded to that liturgy. They vest. They don't vest in these kind of opulent ways, but nonetheless, they're going to look very formal to a low church evangelical around the rest of the Anglican communion. That church would be low church, but it probably wouldn't look that way to an American evangelical. So it's kind of hard that the taxonomy doesn't map on as well as say Presbyterian. A very formal low church Anglican parish is something that exists, but it doesn't look identifiably low church to someone who's maybe coming from an SBC background or even, say, a PCA background.
Right. So speaking of low church or even charismatic, Ann and I worship sometimes at ACNA parishes north of Boston. And it's striking when we do that you see raised hands during songs, etc., but it's with the geriatric set. The young people aren't doing it. These are people who were, I imagine, part of the charismatic contingent of the 70s into the 80s, and this is how they do it in my own congregation here in Hillsdale. I notice people will, very, very few, a few young people do raise hands for certain songs, And then I noticed some of the congregants put their hands out to receive the benediction, as it were. So they're not up, they're down, but they're sort of like they're about to receive a package, and they have their hands that way. So there are these little signs, markers. And is there much of that in Lutheranism, Corey?
I don't think in the same way. I mean, I have seen this, you know, in a congregation that would look not super high church, but would look very liturgical. I mean, I have seen one or two people who might, you know, put their palms up while they're singing. But no, the more typical split would be that's a common practice in some congregations, rather than a common practice of some people in mm-hmm. in many congregations. I think your observation is largely applicable to the LCMS, that it's often the older generation, it's baby boomers who are doing this rather than 20 somethings, with the possible exception of the worship services that, for example, take place on some of our Lutheran college campuses, where, you know, maybe people my age or even older serve as chaplains and are still convinced that this is what the young'uns want. Or maybe they're just sort of conscious of the demographic, you know, aware of the fact that despite this being a Lutheran, an LCMS college, the vast majority of butts in seats are not Lutheran. And so we're kind of catering to, you know, an evangelical audience. But yeah, on the whole, I've very rarely seen that kind of evangelical piety in a normal Sunday service at a typical LCMS congregation. Unless it's a congregation specifically known for that kind of worship.
Yeah. I mean, I should probably say just my own take on Presbyterians. It's, I mean, I've always been struck, and this bears on the question I asked earlier of Corey about the Lutheran tradition in the 16th century and the Book of Concord, and how that may reflect some give and take on these matters, subjective, objective. Internal, external, however you want to frame it. But when I look at the Westminster Standards, and that's in some ways at the high point of Protestant scholasticism. And yet, when it comes to the Ordo Salutis in those standards, there is a box checking or some kind of interior inspection that is really different from, say, Heidelberg. When you look at Heidelberg on conversion, then Heidelberg uses conversion in a very different way. It's just dying to sin, living to Christ. And it's a lifelong process. It's not at all an instantaneous moment. But when you get to the standards, you have much more about the different parts of the Ordo. And then when you get to the Great Awakening among American Presbyterians in the 18th century, did I just say Great Awakening? I meant to say Pretty Good Awakening. I mean, it just the introspection ramps up even more, so that the very plan of union between the old side and new side Presbyterians who split over the revivals is a very long paragraph on all the things that are happening inside the convert or inside the true believer, that even goes, I would say, three or four steps beyond the Westminster Standards. But the irony, perhaps, or at least one different element in this for, say, the OPC, maybe less so for the PCA, is that it's not hard at all to find anti-charismatic conviction among conservative Presbyterians of that stripe, where it's all about the word being complete. There's no new revelation. That's very much part of the Westminster confession. So people take that very seriously. There may be some in the PCA. I know in the 70s when the PCA started, there may have been a kind of charismatic element at times there. And I think maybe the PCA has had to adjust to that. But the OPC had a controversy, a mild controversy back in the 50s and 60s over what, for all intents and purposes, might have been a kind of charismatic moment. And the OPC rejected that, which doesn't mean that people don't emphasize experience in all sorts of ways. But that's the one wrinkle here where oftentimes the Reformed are the most, can be the strongest against charismatic, because it sounds like these people are turning to new revelation. Another, just to pick up on another comment that Corey made, but that I think is quite relevant for the Anglicans. So Corey mentioned Western Christianity at some point, I think, in regard to charismatic movement. So given the number of Lutherans in Africa, which I hear is quite big, and then, of course, ACNA has special ties to African Anglicans. And I don't want to engage in any kind of stereotypes, but you sometimes get the sense that the African churches are much more emotional, or what, it may not be charismatic. I don't have the right words to describe it, but it's not as formal, staid as Western churches can be. And people don't hesitate to point that out. So in the case of ACNA, I wonder if that's a source of some kind of charismatic element, and it makes it harder to perhaps distance yourself from it. But also, I wonder, with LCMS's involvement in Africa and how much of that migrates back, if that's a fair way of describing African church life.
I think the one thing that, as I've understood, so my diocese is, our history is, we're a creation of the Church of Nigeria. And so we kind of got Americanized a few years back. We became in communion with ACNA instead of communion with the Church of Nigeria, which we had been. So I think one of the things that I've kind of realized is that not all African spirituality is charismatic. There are distinct ways that Africans worship that I think is a fully formed Christian tradition that happens to be African. I think there's also that there's charismatic elements that sort of via the Episcopal Church, and less the Church of England, but largely the Episcopal Church, kind of made their way into Africa throughout the 20th century, and African spirituality is more able to receive that in kind of a seamless way. So I think there's a lot of truth to that, that there are more just kind of charismatic expressions of Anglicanism in Africa, and those are the norm. I don't think all of them, all African expressions of Anglican churchmanship are charismatic, but I do think they kind of are able to be charismatic churchmanship is received more easily in Africa, I think, than it is in other places. And so, yeah, it kind of makes it interesting because, of course, that's out of, there's 85, 90 million Anglicans. And most of them, if you're just looking at majorities, are going to be more friendly to something that looks charismatic, whether it's not de facto charismatic theologically or not. But there's going to be more movement and worship. And what's funny is some of those churches are also very formal at the same time. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting is Africans, even though their worship is expressive, a lot of times they would not fit the bill for charismatic worship at all. It would look more like just kind of what you might call traditional Black church, right? Women dress very formally, men dress very formally. Think of the kind of just unbelievably beautiful garb that Nigerian women wear to church. I mean, it's this unbelievably ornate garments and whatnot, and yet they might be more expressive in worship. So it's hard to I think peg it to charismatic Christianity per se, but at the same time there is the ability to receive charismatic worship more easily in our African provinces. And so I know that sounds convoluted, and I think that's because it is. I don't think there's an easy definition on it. So,
no, I'd say the same thing from my perspective. Unquestionably, Lutheran worship in the African churches is far more expressive than it is in a typical North American parish. Maybe that is just down to ethnic cultural differences. I mean, Germans are not known for being particularly expressive in the first place. Scandinavians aren't either. And that makes up a lot of traditional North American Lutheranism. To second something Miles says, not only among the laity, but the African clergy who are Lutheran. I mean, for example, Bishop Walter Obare spoke at the commencement of one of our seminaries, and it was probably 10 years ago now, actually probably more than 10 years ago. And he's a bishop, and he showed up dressed like a bishop with cope and bishop's mitre. And you don't really see anyone in North American Lutheranism, no matter how high church they are, trying to get away with that. But he wasn't sort of putting on airs. That's just, he's a bishop, so he dresses like a bishop. So on the one hand, a lot of the African Lutheran church looks much more formal, much more high church than you would get even in the highest LCMS churches. But yeah, on the other hand, it's also far more expressive, far more in various respects spontaneous. And so, yeah, I think Miles is right that it's kind of hard to map these categories of low church, charismatic, high church, the way we tend to do in a European and American context.
I think I just want to add this. I think the bishops thing is really interesting. African bishops have considerably more command over their clergy than American.
For sure. Yes.
I don't know if it's the same in Lutheran circles or not.
Yes.
It's definitely the case in ACNA or in the Anglican Communion. I think one of the things is it's not uncommon to see laity prostrate themselves, or not laity, to see presbyters prostrate themselves in front of bishops. My bishop, that doesn't happen if he were to come to my church. I'm just going to prostrate him. But African clergy I've done it. It's happened at Synod. I've seen it happen. It happens at Synod. And that's not something that's unusual in Africa. And I think some of it's because the experience of these men aren't merely bishops. They're also kind of cultural protectors too, especially in Nigeria. That's the case. And so they just carry a lot more weight. And because of that, the churches tend to be much more ecclesiastically, just in that bare minimum, kind of use of the term high church. The church authorities mean something in Africa.
Well, let's go to this week's sponsor. Don't laugh. Finally, an office chair with 21st century technology and design. There is no need to compromise. X Chair enables users both to look good and be more productive. The all new X Chair advances the function of office seating. It is distinctly stylish, budget-friendly, and made with proprietary ergonomic comfort technology that has never been applied to office seating. The X-Chair molds to the shape of the user's body. 10 ergonomic adjustments make this glove-like fit possible. A seat with adjustable height and depth, a height-adjustable backrest, a headrest with adjustable height and angle, four-dimensional armrests with adjustable height, width, depth, and angle, adjustable tilt tension, and a tilt lock. Yet the X-Chair's greatest ergonomic feat is one that needs no adjusting. The proprietary dynamic variable lumbar. Support adjusts itself to the user's shape in order to provide perfect lumbar support from the moment they hit the seat. The health benefits of X-Chair's technology are numerous. SciFloat Infinite Recline technology allows the user to remain in motion throughout the day, which is proven to increase blood flow and focus. Each model of the chair features flex mesh technology, which suspends the user to remove weight from sensitive pressure points that impede blood flow and cause discomfort. The unprecedented adjustability of the X-Chair ensures that each user is able to maximize every feature and enjoy an ergonomic seat customized to them.
Wow, okay. That was long.
It was.
Where do I buy one?
Go to xchair.com, I think. All right. You're not a real podcast unless you have an ad. There are a lot of sort of ideas floating around with what hot Protestantism looks like. Charismatic, hands raised, worship styles. We haven't talked about relevance or church growth, which are sometimes, I remember back into the 80s when those were ideas that sometimes fueled more user-friendly, less formal. And that's another one. Is it less formal versus formal? But I think part of what I wonder about with Anglicans and Lutherans, among Presbyterians, I think there's a kind of hotness in the sense that people, church members are expected, I mean, expected may be too strong, but you should show your faith. You should show a degree of intentionality, of that it should inform what you do and be evident. You know, it's hard in some ways to figure out how it's evident if people aren't around to see you, especially at home. But the idea that talk of church, talk of scripture, talk of theology of Christ should be on your lips. Are those kinds of expectations around among Lutherans and Anglicans too? Or can you, in what George Whitefield or someone might have called simply go through the motions, is going through the motions good enough in a way in your traditions?
I wondered if we would get to this because we were talking about worship, and worship is maybe one measure of these sorts of things. But I've heard, I don't think I've ever heard this phrase till I came to Hillsdale. Started hanging around Presbyterians, but what's the phrase that you use, Daryl, for devotions at home?
Family worship.
Family worship. No. Yeah. I'd never heard that phrase before.
Hmm.
But I assume that it's, you know, more or less what we would call, you know, family devotions in our household. In the morning, my wife does devotions as part of the beginning of the school day with kids, and that usually involves reading from a couple different books. And then in the evening, as we're getting ready for bed, we've got a couple more books, and they kind of follow the liturgical year, and so it's still very structured. But yeah, I mean, there is a kind of expectation, or let me say it this way. Among the clergy, at least, there is an expectation that their congregations are doing more than showing up on Sunday. That they are cultivating piety in the home with the family. I have no idea how widespread that is. I know that, for example, my own church body, through its publishing house, makes available a lot of wonderful stuff for those who do want to follow some sort of regular devotional schedule. And the fact that they print it, I mean, I guess that does suggest that it's popular. I mean, you don't print stuff if nobody's going to buy it.
Right.
Having said that, though, I don't know that there's a lot of public religiosity So we do what we do on Sunday morning. We do what we do at home with the family. But I don't see a lot of Lutherans just kind of casually dropping, you know, God bless you and amen, you know, in the checkout line, that kind of thing.
Or how about the phrase Lord willing or God willing? I mean, is that
Lord? Yeah. Yeah, I do. I actually hear that more often.
Yeah,
I do hear that more often.
Yeah. What about Anglicans, Miles?
I think this is probably the single biggest difference between my background is only the Presbyterian Church. So I've never been a Baptist or anything like that. But I think the biggest difference is that there isn't the expectation that you need to have some sort of public or even private psycho-emotive framework for your faith outside of kind of orthopraxy at church. So if you go to church, I think it would be the difference between the assumption between someone goes to church, they, you know, participate in the rite, they receive the sacrament, they go home, they say a prayer at night, they go to bed. I think for a lot of Anglicans, and I don't want to throw the tradition under the bus, because I actually think this is a good thing. There isn't this necessarily this tendency to think, okay, I just saw you pray and take communion, but do you really believe?
Right.
You know, sort of like, do you really, you know, think? And it's like, well, I just, like, what the hell do you want? I just prayed and took communion. And so I think there's a Calvinist impulse to almost like there's this kind of suspicion.
Right.
It's like, I think an Anglican would see someone take communion and go to church, and, you know, as long as there's not, you know, a known, you know, violent person in the household, I think they're like, oh, that person's probably a Christian. I don't think it's all Calvinist. I think it's maybe the hot Calvinist impulse is to say, well, what else are you doing to let us know that you're really a Christian? So I think some of that might be the difference between prioritizations of liturgies and the sacrament. Some of it might be kind of a hot innovation of Calvinism, within Calvinism, not from Calvinism, but within Calvinism. But I think that's the biggest difference. It's kind of this need to have some sort of extra psycho-emotional confirmation. Are you really into it?
Yeah. I mean, and for Calvinists who are Presbyterian, I think oftentimes people in my tribe think that a lack of emotion is typical of liberalism. And so to prove that you're not a theological liberal, you have to show a certain kind of intensity or earnestness. And in fact, it is the case that liberals have been among the squishiest, sentimental, experientialist types imaginable, because they were the ones that were resisting the confession, the formalism, and finding all sorts of ways, you know, and liberal theology included, but all sorts of ways to sort of move away from the dead orthodoxy into something much more vibrant. And that vibrancy can take all sorts of things. Liberal for liberal Protestants, it can go really high church, but it can also be cheek by jowl with all sorts of other, maybe more emotive experiential expressions. And there's no kind of check on that coming from theological standards. But the other side of it too, and we're all now in a voluntarist system of church life and no establishment. But for Presbyterians in Scotland, say in the 18th century, when you are the state church, you don't want to look like you're too unusual for the rest of the population of Scotland. You don't want to have a kind of piety that's going to be goofy, to use an imprecise word. So you have to do something a little bit more modest, a little bit more sensible, a little bit more stately, formal, that supports the public order. And I think that's a big tradition in the Church of Scotland in the 18th century, and the moderate impulse that then both seceders in the 1730s and then the Free Church in the 1840s move away from. For Presbyterians in North America, the categories are coming largely from the revivals, and how to relate to that, and that the church establishment is not part of the package. But there's that other side of Presbyterianism that does still have that state church background that can affect it. And I wonder if that's in any way playing out among Lutherans in North America or Anglicans as well.
Yeah,
that's a good question. And I don't know. I mean, certainly the state church and Lutheranism is a big part of the continental European heritage. And I think at least in some respects, it informs developments in North America. So, for example, one of the critiques of and one of the problems with, you know, the Pietist movement is that in an attempt to cultivate a further piety beyond the, you know, the formal service on Sunday, some of these conventicles kind of displaced church on Sunday. Right. And so there's been a kind of backlash against that. And I mean, certainly you can find, you know, the quote unquote small group movement in North American Lutheranism, but it's typically not something that is encouraged by pastors. And so again, that's one of those kind of fine lines that people walk. How do we encourage people to take their faith more seriously than just, you know, showing up for an hour and 5 minutes on Sunday morning, without turning them loose to, you know, do all sorts of silliness, not supervised by the clergy. So it's an ongoing debate.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of this, Daryl, you're exactly right. I mean, the change from being a state church to a voluntarist church affects Presbyterians and Anglicans. I think it's uniquely British in that sense. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, before you have this established religion, you really do have the state kind of doing the job of checking up on people's pieties. Well, how do you know someone's a Christian? How do you know there's someone in good standing with the community? Well, because they were at church. We haven't arrested them for church non-attendance. So I think that change is interesting because you have the individuals or the session or kind of whoever's a part of the church is sort of stepping in to fill an institutional role that was never sort of seen as being a piety check. It was almost being a civilizational check.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so I think that distinction is really important. Right. Do you really, really believe what belief itself kind of means something different when it's just a question of piety and not a question of society being ordered or something like that?
I mean, as hot as Protestants, Presbyterians can look compared, and especially I think it comes a lot down to worship styles or orders of service. And we in Hillsdale are more liturgical than others. But you know, I think we at our congregation, as much as there may be expectations for people to be more active beyond Sundays, I mean, we have an evening service that probably maybe 20% of the congregation comes back for. And there's no talk of disciplining anyone or even having to, you know, there may be some kind of messages Sunday morning, it'd be really good if you came back. And if we meet with people, we may, as officers, we may try to encourage people to come back, but there's no sense of, well, you're not really a good Christian or a good church member if you don't come back to the evening service. So in effect, Presbyterians have a seemingly as similar outlook as other groups, where Sunday morning observance is sort of the bellwether. If someone's not coming on Sunday mornings, they will get eventually a call from someone. So it is, but it is also, I think, fascinating to think about from scripture, at least, and this is the Presbyterian in me, I guess you got to go to the word, but where you go for the kind of day-to-day standards that you would measure yourself as a good Christian. It seems like a lot of the stuff that may be daily exercises are add-ons that people have come up with over the years to develop it. And, you know, if you have kids, it makes perfect sense. You want to expose them to prayer and teach them how to pray and read scripture with them and encourage them in the faith and the like. And it certainly makes a lot of sense to have family worship, even when you're older. But where, you know, where does it say that? Well, it doesn't necessarily say that. So it's a curious thing, the way piety gets played out. But I do think, you know, maybe one last question before we wrap up is, I know Miles and I have gone back and forth at times on Twitter about earnestness. And I guess, you know, we should mention, if people who are listening, the many thousands who are going to buy X chairs, my Twitter handle is @oldlife, one word, OLDLIFE. And yours, Miles, is
@IVMiles.
Okay. And maybe this will encourage Dr. Moss to get on Twitter at some point, but so far he's not. But the degree to which earnestness is it's a very common trait, it seems to me, for evangelicals.
Yeah.
But there's a big overlap between evangelicalism and conservative Presbyterianism for all sorts of reasons. And so it's not unusual to have a lot of earnest people in an Orthodox Presbyterian congregation, and a lot of pastors who are fairly earnest in ways that sometimes I might find uncomfortable personally. But is there an earnest meter for Lutherans or Anglicans about what's too much, what's the right amount, how much a pastor has to have or a priest?
Not that I've noticed or heard any commentary on. I mean, it informally in personal conversations that I've had with Lutherans over the years, I mean, there are hints of that. So, I mean, I myself have been accused, you know, only partly in jest, of being, you know, far too stoic and far too unemotional. Because, you know, if you really have the joy of Jesus, then that should show. And I mean, I haven't heard that often, but yeah, there are people even in Lutheran circles who firmly believe that that's the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's definitely kind of a cage stage, almost liturgical earnestness that you find in modern Anglican churches, because you've got people coming from a church without a liturgy, and, like, you know, sort of, I think what the doctrine of election can be for Presbyterians, the prayer book typically is for Anglicans, that people feel like they've really got it now and they're so excited. and so I think you do have this kind of real sense of earnestness in Anglican circles. And of course it can take the form of vestments too. I think it speaks to the power of novelty in American religion in a lot of ways. And so I think that it's new, you do have a lot of people get really excited because they're programmed to be enthusiast by revivalist adjacent fundamentalist or evangelical churches. And it's sort of, once they figure out, I mean, that's a little silly, maybe that's, they don't lose that programming. They want to sort of latch on to something like a better version of it.
Right.
And I think Anglicanism can be that for a lot of people.
I would be just sorry. Brief aside.
No, go ahead.
I do sometimes wonder how people outside of Lutheranism, and not so much now, but maybe like in the sort of heydays of the 50s and 60s, when the Lutheran hour was a big thing,
mm-hmm.
and so people who may never have darkened the door of a Lutheran church would have heard someone like Walter Meyer on the radio, and you know, Meyer got flack from within Lutheranism for a variety of things, kind of, you know, downplaying sacraments because not everyone listening is a Lutheran, etc. But But I would be curious to know if that was people's introduction to Lutheranism, if they would have a very different perspective than someone like me who grew up in it has. If they would think, oh yeah, well, if Lutheran Hour is representative, then that's really earnest preaching. Or if they would think, well, no, that's just radio preaching.
Was he pretty earnest?
I think so. Yeah. And
I've not heard him.
Some of his successors have been as well. Certainly not all of them, but
because when I hear ads, some of the radio stations I listen to, especially WGY in Albany, reasons for that. But I hear ads for the Lutheran Hour, and it sounds like it's taking me back to the 70s for when the CRC, I think the CRC still has the Back to God Hour. Okay. And it just sounds more formal, though, even the advertisements.
Okay.
But they don't really feature what the preacher's going to sound like. They don't have clips on
gotcha.
The ads.
Yeah. Sure.
Well, we should stop there for the sake of today. And thanks for being with me, you guys. And thanks for whoever's listening for coming along. And we'll hope to do something soon. But buy an X chair. All right. Take care.
Thanks, Corey. Okay. Thanks, Daryl.